Genesis history 4, and we come to an extraordinary juncture of ideas and intuition, of perception and of feeling. Those four qualities generally are the way in which intelligent distribution of typology vis-a-vis human beings has been settled. Sensation, feeling, thinking, intuition. You could get a very nice précis of this by reading Carl Jung's book, The Psychology of Types. And Jung himself shows that the history of this goes back to a number of interesting individuals. One of the most profound of them was Schiller. And Schiller's theory of human types, that human beings come in such interesting, repeating patterns that there can be typologies of people. And of course, the classic typology was always the signs of the zodiac, the 12 signs of the zodiac as being distributive types, that there's an Aries person, or there's a Libra person, or a Leo person. Or that these qualities somehow can be fitted together in various proportions, in ratios, and one can come out with a very interesting characteristic of people. This geometry of typology goes back profoundly many thousands of years. The origins of it lie at the very foundations of civilization, that the heavenly patterns of stars have an influence upon the qualities which life has, that our Earth is the focus, the center of a zodiac, or that in terms of Schiller and Jung, our personality is a focus of functions of our being, the sensation, the feeling, the thinking, the intuitive functions. Those four functions are functions of a dynamic psyche, while the zodiacal distribution are functions of a divine psyche. This movement from a celestial typology to a psychological typology is part of the growth and transformation in history that has happened over several thousand years. What is interesting for us here at History 4 is to recognize a very fundamental truth which can be backed up in terms of mathematics. You can transform objectivities individually. The alchemist takes his lead and turns that into gold. Or the alchemist takes the lead in himself and turns that into the gold in himself. Transformations of individuals can be done with objectivity. But transformations of processes can only be done by sets. So that you must learn set transformation in order to master processes. It means that there has to be a recognition of a distinctiveness of application in terms of individuals or in terms of processes, or to put it in our language typology, objective phases can have transformation based upon unities, based upon singularities, based upon individualities. But the phases of processes require sets, they require sequences, they require vectors in order to deal with transformations. So that if you look to transform a process phase, you cannot do it yourself, nor could anyone in this universe do it on the basis of a unity, on the basis of a singularity. So that if you have a built-in prejudice, which the Western mind has had now for some couple hundred years, the prejudice that one has to find integration, and when you find integration and you have integrated, then you apply that integration and you get the desired effect. The integration to unity has effect only on those objective phases. It has no appreciable effect, other than muddying the waters, on the process phases. So that integration is of profound interest when you're dealing with ritual, or you're dealing with symbol, or you're dealing with art, and as we will see, if you're dealing with science. But it's a positive detriment if you insist upon integration to the point of objective unity and try to apply that to nature. It doesn't work. It's like the search for the ultimate building block of nature. When we identify the ultimate building block of nature, we will then be able to analyze her. And so we look for that fundamental building block, that singular, unitary, individual item or atom, and it cannot be found. It cannot be found because it is hidden. It cannot be found because it does not occur in the application. The ultimate building block, either the molecule or the atom or the quark, whatever kind of particularity, make up a Joycean word here, whatever speck can be identified objectively works in terms of existence, works in terms of the body, works in terms of ritual, but is not applicable to nature. Nature mysteriously retreats before those kinds of attempts to cross the T's and dot the I's, and there's no limit to that because it never happens. One never dots the I's and crosses the T's in terms of the process of nature. Someone once wrote that the spirit of nature is feminine. And when she is seized upon in this way, she lifts her skirts and she hies away to, that's a Scottish word, it means runs away, to somewhere else. She flees from you. She will not participate with you. But not only is this true of nature, it is also true of all the other processes. It's true of vision. You cannot atomize in and apply to vision. Like nature, it just simply retreats. Now, nature and vision are fairly simple to understand that you cannot do this. But it becomes a very pernicious problem when you realize that you cannot do this in terms of the other two processes also, which are myth and history. You cannot identify a particulate structure in myth, in language, in feeling, and expect to have it apply. Myth, like nature or like vision, is a process and transforms only by sets, not by individuality. So it's changing. Its changeableness are all functions of its kind of fluidity. Its structure is not in terms of particles, but always in terms of waves. And the waves are always in terms of sets, so that one talks about vibration. There was a Swiss genius early in the 20th century named Hans Jenny, who used to take particles of very fine sand and he would put them on a surface that was like a drum skin, and then he would apply a sound, and the sound waves would arrange the little bits of dust into patterns, and they turned out to be universal yantras, mandalas of sound. And one could see that the various sounds and various pitches made different patterns, so that the particulate quality, the particle quality, is always influenced by the underlying process, so that the particular objectivity of existence is always influenced by nature. The particular objectivity of symbols is always influenced by language. And the particular objectivity of persons is always influenced by the process of vision. And just so, we will see that the process of history influences what objectively is real in the cosmos. To put it in blunt apocalyptic language, heaven is dependent upon history. The shape of heaven, its actual shape, is very much dependent upon what happens and how it happens in history. Which is why one runs across the phrase in really intense times of total truth, one hears the phrase that God is the Lord of history. That there's something peculiarly poignant in that, and that the responsibility of human beings is that we create a great deal of what is history. And so we have a responsibility. As Kazantzakis would say, you have to grow up from the adolescent who stands on the seashore and throws rocks at the surf, crying out to the sea, make me a god. That's what Kazantzakis did when he was like an adolescent in Crete. You have to grow up from that, and you have to realize that you are the only particular, the only particulate who can participate in the process of history. The rocks cannot do it. The minerals cannot do it. The plants cannot do it. The animals cannot do it. And most human beings cannot do it. It is only the transformed psyche that reaches its maturity, not exclusively in integration, but with the complement of differentiation also in play. Only then can one deal with history. And then one has only bought a ticket to a very complex show. Then you have to deal with transformation by sets, which means that you have to be able to recognize sets. And sets are vectors, they're sequences, they're alignments that have a purpose, and they don't necessarily have to have beginnings. They can be midstream. They don't necessarily have to have end purposes. They can just veer in some directionality. One of the great symbols early in the 20th century in phenomenological symbolism was to draw an arrow, the arrow of intention. That consciousness always involves an arrowing from somewhere to somewhere else, and all that one can be sure of is that it's pointing. It's going in some direction, in some vector. The civilized prototype of that is from the Gospel of St. John. St. John, a Hellenistic Jew who had very interesting teachers, and he used it in a parable about Nicodemus, who asked, what about the Spirit? And was told, well, the Spirit is like a wind that blows in. No one knows from where. One only knows that it's blowing here, and it After a while, it blows out. Where it goes, we don't know. But that it does blow here, that we know. All this is to say that the directions do not have to have beginnings, middles, and ends. That would be myth. All mythic vectors must have beginnings, middles, and ends. Because their myth is like nature, it's an integral process. One asks then, what's the beginning in nature? And the beginning is always the mysterious. The cloud of unknowing. And what is the end? The end is this peculiar mystery which is not unknowing, but is total knowing. So that the ultimate vector that would develop in an integral fashion is that one comes out of a mystery and goes through the process of recognizing that it is mysterious, and you come to know it. But the whole differential quality is that one then blows back out of the room into the ever-widening, ever-opening universe. One of the great descriptions of this at the end of the science fiction novel, The Voyage of the Space Beagle by A.E. Van Vogt, the conclusion is, and carrying its little bit of human civilization, the expeditionary ship Space Beagle sped at an ever-increasing velocity through a night that had no end and no beginning. And so the deep mystic wisdom of human beings resurfacing in the science fiction of the World War II era, the golden age of science fiction, the archetypal deep wisdom of men and women was that we must understand we cannot push nature around. We cannot push vision around. We cannot push myth around or history. They are processes. And in their process quality, they are dynamic. Complementary to the dynamic of a process is the energy of an objectivity. An objectivity has energy. And it's a difficulty because of the mulching, of the undisciplined blending, not to make the distinction enough so that one can understand that when you're dealing with energy, you're dealing with a presencing. Objectivity presences, and it presences in two distinct different ways. One is an integral way, so that there's something there, the body is here. One of the great early problems of the theory of evolution was to explain, and Darwin was extraordinarily honest in it, and it wasn't recognized for about two generations. He talks about the origin of species. Not about how man comes to be in general, but how does a man come to be? How does this distinct individual, this existential species, that man there, how does he come to be out of a process? It's totally alchemical, as one would say, in the valley in the 1990s. It's totally alchemical. That to precipitate objectivity out of a process means that there was some transformation working in the structure of the process, that the sets of the process had arranged themselves in some way that they had junctures. And where those junctures were, there is where objectivity happens. One of the most profound investigators of this mysterious quality was Benjamin Franklin. He was investigating the universal current that manifested itself in lightning And he was the first person to recognize that when you had it, what you had was electricity. And that only when you have the positive and negative pole actively in tension with each other, is there such a thing as electricity. But there's a mystery here. Electricality is a vector, now that we know, of the electromagnetic process. When you have a process, you register that process in a spectrum, like the electromagnetic spectrum, going from radio waves up to the ultraviolet. This kind of a spectrum of a process has an opportunity only at certain junctures in that spectrum to have objectivity. It is only a very narrow bandwidth of electromagnetism where visible light is possible. And it's only at exactly certain frequencies that one has. So many ten thousandths of an angstrom will give you orange light. If it's changed so many ten thousandths of an angstrom is a measurement so small that human hairs are huge compared to it. If you change it just several ten thousandths of an angstrom, it will not be orange light, it will be green light. That the color is a physiological registering of a frequency which is exact. One can tune it in. Like a radio station, if you don't tune it in, it becomes blurred. So there's such a thing as getting the radio station, there's such a thing as pure orange light, there's such a thing as pure blue, there's such a thing as pure red. It's measurable. Why is it measurable? Because the existence is objective to the nth degree. It's one of the conundrums of reality that mysteries are really mysterious and objectivities are really objective. They actually occur with exactness. One of the great difficulties in mastering a yoga is to understand that the objectivity is immediately exactly what it is. Nothing else, that, exactly that, only that, always that, and this quality of pointedness, single pointedness, ekagrata, this single pointedness is a poignancy which allows then for the objectivity of reality to be understood and calibrated. Not just measured, calibrated. So that one can come to understand exactly and precisely what one has knowledge of. And exactly at the same time, in great complementary balance to it, when one comes to understand exactly what one knows, you understand also that you do not know what you don't know. It isn't that it's missing, it's that not knowing, that ignorance becomes luminous. It's not an ignorance because you don't know, it's an ignorance because you know. It's called Socratic ignorance. But it's misnamed Socratic ignorance because actually its discoverer, the original teacher of this, was a woman, the teacher of Socrates. Her name was Diotima, and she came from Mantinea. And so she was sometimes called the Mantinean, because there's a kind of a play on words in ancient Greek. Mantis means diviner, like oracle. Well, Diotima was a Pythagorean oracle. She was one of those rare individuals that roamed the Greek world and put things right because she could focus exactly. She was like a roving Delphic oracle Only instead of the Delphic oracle, which was always a young girl who was positioned someplace, she was differential. She was able to go wherever she needed to go. And she's the one that taught Socrates. He says so in Plato's Symposium. He gives this very interesting kind of dialogue that he had with Diotima. It's very difficult for us to appreciate. It's very difficult for anybody at the time. Socrates, in the midst of this conversation on love and trying to understand anything, says, but there is an account of love which I heard from a woman called Diotima, who came from Mantinea and was an expert in love, as well as in a large number of other areas too. Well, she was a universal Pythagorean sage. For instance, on one occasion, when the Athenians performed their sacrificial rites to ward off the plague, she delayed the onset of the disease for 10 years. The account of that is in Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War. We'll come to that in a minute. She also taught me the ways of love. And I'll try to repeat for you what she told me. I'll base myself on the conclusions which Agathon, a Greek tragedian who's at this dinner, the symposium is a dinner where they're discussing things, and very interesting population of people. Agathon is there, Aristophanes, the great comedian, is there, Socrates is there, a number of distinguished people of the time, and as we will see, as soon as Socrates ends Diotima's teaching, in comes the most peculiar figure in the whole of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, someone that Thucydides singled out as interesting to show how the process of history transforms in terms of the individuals who participate radically in the arrangement of the sets. And if the individuals are not really together, then the sets transform in very strange and detrimental ways. In other words, what becomes chaotic in history is not because there are evil geniuses out there pulling puppet strings from alien perspectives, but because someone very powerful has gotten it wrong. And we live in a time where super powerful individuals are on their way. The 21st century is going to be characterized by very capable, super powerful individuals. Let's hope there's not an Alcibiades. That's the kicker, today's lecture. We'll all live to see it. Heinlein wrote a future history in which one of them actually happened, called Revolt in 2100. A theological demagogue takes over the United States and thus the world, and it takes a long suffering time to deal with it. Heinlein wrote a future history because he recognized, as many of us are coming to recognize, that history does not deal with the past. History deals with a differential process which is equally in the future as in the past. And there's as much future history as there is past history in any real history. And that what we're trying to learn here is to disallow the ignorance which has commended itself to us and disallow the knowledge which has commended itself to us, because we've been entrusted with both these bags, and it's both these saddlebags of ignorance and knowledge which are false. Both are false. To the same degree, they are false, and we are carrying them together, and there's something else that's there that Socrates learned from Diotima. What does he recount now? I'll see if I can manage on my own, says Socrates, and he goes into a reverie to teach in the way in which Diotima taught him. As you explained, Agathon, it's important to start with a description of love's nature and characteristics before turning to what he does. I think the easiest way for me to do this is to repeat the account the woman from Mantinea once gave me in the course of a question and answer session we were having, so that Plato learned philosophic dialogue from Socrates, but Socrates learned it from Diotima. Because the question and answer dialogue form is actually a feminine form of inquiry. I had been saying to her, in my own words, almost exactly what Agathon just now was saying to me, that love is an important god and must be accounted attractive. She used the same arguments I used on him to prove that it was actually, that all of this actually followed from my own ideas that love wasn't attractive or good. "What?" I exclaimed. "Do you mean to tell me, Diotima, that love is repulsive and bad? That it isn't attractive and good? That it's repulsive and bad?" "You should be careful what you say," she replied. "Do you think that anything which isn't attractive must be then repulsive?" "Yes, I certainly do," said the young Socrates. "Diotima, do you think that lack of knowledge is the same as ignorance? Haven't you noticed that there's middle ground between knowledge and ignorance?" "What middle ground?" "True belief," she replied. In other words, eternal truth is in between knowledge and ignorance. "Don't you realize that as long as it isn't supported by a justification, true belief isn't knowledge, because you must be able to explain what you know, but isn't ignorance either, because ignorance can't have any involvement with the truth of things? In fact, of course, true belief is what I said it was, an intermediate area between knowledge and ignorance. So that a third quality enters in. Now, when you're dealing with threes, you're always dealing then with centers. When you're dealing with twos, you're dealing with the polarities of beginning and end, positive and negative. But when you're dealing with middles, if you're dealing with a process, you're dealing with a flow, you're dealing with everything that's in movement between the poles. The middle of a circuit is the electricity. And when you focus on that, when you forget the poles, when you deal only with not the phenomenon of electricity, here's where the habit of knowledge and ignorance as a dualistic imprint of what reality is supposed to be completely collapses. You cannot talk about the phenomena of a process. We in the 20th century have come to use a Greek term which is complementary to phenomena, which was introduced by Rudolf Otto in The Idea of the Holy. He used the Greek term, reintroduced it in the 20th century, the term noumenon. Something numinous glows with the veracity and reality of a process but cannot be identified. Something numinous cannot be identified. A phenomena must be identifiable. It must be objective. The body, in order to be effective, has to be objectively, existentially a phenomena. The body. But language or nature or vision or history are all numinous. They not only resist being designated as phenomena, they absolutely don't respond to it at all. And so one becomes super agitated, completely willful, when one tries to stamp onto a process a numinous set of doctrinal rules. It will be this way. Well, it won't. You want to stop up the flow of a mighty river like the Colorado and build a Hoover Dam? Well, the river stops here. Well, yes, but there's such a thing as earthquakes. There's such a thing as the change of magnetic poles. I mean, the whole continent might flip. What's going to happen to your Hoover Dam? You think it's big. It's nothing. The whole star system might shudder. The whole galaxy might collide with another galaxy. If you want to talk about damming up nature, you have to get megalomaniac to an infinite degree to even get into the game, and then you're not effective at all. The ridiculous Marx Brothers point that I'm making here is that it's an endless tomfoolery to even try this kind of strategy because it doesn't work. What Diotima finally educated Socrates to learn was that knowledge and ignorance always have a complementation in reality, but what holds that complementation is not affected by either. It's not affected by the ignorance or the knowledge. And you have to transform your focus, your attention, from not wanting the ignorance and also from not possessing the knowledge. You have to not go from one to the other or from the other to the one, but one has to strike a balance with both of them so that something else occurs, something else emerges, that your attentiveness goes elsewhere out of the ping-pong game of polarities. And as long as you're running towards knowledge or something attractive, desirable, and running away from something unattractive, undesirable, ignorance, you're caught in this kind of fleeting shadow play of which there is no wisdom. And Diotima taught philosophy, that love of wisdom, love of the transcendent third, love of seeing that phenomena and noumena play cooperatively, mutually, in a shared way together, in a reality which is beyond phenomenon and beyond noumenon also. That at that order, one then enters into a transformed, not only transformed possibility of one's person, of one's objective person, but one enters for the first time into the player level of being able to participate in processes like nature. How does the classic alchemist change lead from gold? By being so much an integral part of nature. Because when the individual becomes transformed, that transformed individual can participate in a process and help creatively align the vectors, align the sequences. And when those sets are made, and those sets transform because the transformed individual is a part of them, then they change. Then nature makes gold. It's just that you can't make gold out of lead in a medieval alchemical laboratory, no matter how beautifully drawn the engravings are from how rare books. But in modern nuclear reactors like the CERN, cyclotron, one can make gold anytime that you raise the energy high enough and just make the atomic structure of whatever material you're doing, that of gold. But you have to have a transformed differential psyche whose conscious time-space is able to enter into the processes of nature at that kind of level and set up those vectors, those sequences. You have to be able to accelerate particles and energize them to enough intensity, then yes, you can make gold. It's this kind of quality of depth of understanding that the educational systems that have been in place for the last 300 years are not only ignorant of, but have false knowledge. They're not only stupid, but they're egotistically willful at the same time. There has been no medium ground for quite a long time now. And the history of the last 300 years are attempts of men and women to try somehow to bring back into play ancient wisdom. Why it was discredited is another story. It's a long, sad tale to be told by firelight. Nevertheless, it happened. The warfare between science and religion is a product of a split. A split not in the psyche between something, but a fracture exactly where there would be a mutuality of realization. Exactly there's the split between knowledge and ignorance, maintained willfully, that somehow that's all the possibilities there are. That in itself is a form of schizophrenia. And that civilizations have schizophrenia is not to be wondered at all. Their individuality, their phenomenal quality, participates in an objectivity, which is largely that of the symbols of the mind. Very few times is there ever a civilization that becomes artistic. It occasionally happens. But there's never been a science civilization. And that's what's going on now. Not only the attempts to get educated again in some fundamentally realistic way, but to build a phenomenal cosmos, which is scientifically real, that has poetry, has beauty, has love, has life, as all of this in play. Let's come back after the break and we'll go into this further. Let's come back and refocus ourselves. Notice that the education is a constant interplay between focusing intensely and then allowing the focus to recede. So this kind of a pattern is a nurturing pattern. It's a life-giving pattern. It's like there's a day where one focuses one's attention, then there's a night where you leave it unfocused. It's important to see that both these qualities together give us a superior mode of apperception. To constantly base oneself on perception alone leads to a flattened conception. There needs to be a contextual awareness that goes along with perception. So much so that when sight was first developing color, about 70 million years ago, was the first time that color-sensitive sight was being developed, largely in the primates, the great apes, who were needing in a forest canopy environment to see which fruits were ripe and which were not. And so this quality of seeing, one objectifies, one focuses one's vision in color, stereoptic color focus, in order to see, but there is this penumbra of awareness around that even the early apes had, that one knows it's not just the fruit, but one is keeping one's balance and you're in the canopy of trees, and so the context is always there in terms of awareness. Perception has this built in. The identification of form by Gestalt is well known. There's a book on perception in art by Rudolf Arnheim as a famous illustration in it, where there's this curve, there's a couple of sharp angles, there's a couple of straight lines arranged in pairs of threes, and then there's a large curve, and one sees a cat. One sees a cat from the indications. A form can be partially covered up, and yet, when you know the form, you can recognize it from just a part. This is true even 70 million years ago, and we're very sophisticated beyond this. But a kind of ignorance, a regressive forgetting, comes into play in exactly the way in which the mind, in which symbols, do not mature out of language in a very wholesome way. And this problem becomes exacerbated when it comes to dealing with history. The problems of myth are of such a nature, the process of myth is a complement to the process of history. So much are they a complement that the more that one comes into the play, the more the other seems to recede into what we could call subconsciousness or inattention. Actually, in the development of consciousness, history is a very recent process. The process of history, like the process of vision, is a differential process and not at all there in nature. History does not occur in time-space. It occurs in conscious time-space. Just as vision does not occur in time-space, it's always transcendental. It's always supernatural. Visionary sight is not seeing with the eyes, but it's a seeing in a way in which the mind projects out. It's a visionary seeing. And this visionary seeing is a complement to, and in some ways, it's the inside out of perceptual vision. When you look to see what's what in this world, you look to focus and to see the phenomena. And you see it stereoptically focused in color, and that's how we survive. But to transpose that perceptual mode into the interiorization does a lot of damage. The inner seeing, if you take a focus away, you come to the belief that somehow you're going to focus on an internal image, and that that image then is in some way referentially related to the phenomenon outside. One says, well, I have an image of a tree, or the classic philosophic image is the image of a kitchen chair. This is from Immanuel Kant. I have an image of a kitchen chair in my mind, and the question is that image real? I have an image of a unicorn in my mind. Is that unicorn real? And out of all of this kind of concern comes this subject-object duality, subject-object split. But the subjective, as you can see from our education, what is called subjective, the personal, is a differential form which is quite distinct from the bodily existence form. A form in art, like the person, I love Virginia Satir's title of one of her books, The Art of Person Making. Persons are artistically created. The artist makes themselves. And that person is quite distinct from the existential body. And also quite distinct from the mind. The integral mind is quite objective. Ideas are quite objective. Images in the mind, in an integral sense, are quite real. And in this way, we can say, yes, I have a very clear image in my mind. My visualization of an orange ball is quite exact. And I could make a correlation between the image of an orange ball in my mind and seek to make or find or discover or draw an orange ball out here. But the differential consciousness, the inner mind, has a different capacity. It's a different mode. It's not at all the transposition of external seeing to an internal seeing. There is a limitation on internal seeing because one can condense more and more. One can index a whole image base into some kind of a symbol, internalize that symbol. There is no correlation in the phenomenal world to that symbol whatsoever. I have a very clear symbol in my mind now of a Tai Chi, the Tai Chi Chuan. Where is the thing in the world that corresponds to that? One can say, well, that's a process. Yes, you can have a symbol of a process, just as you can have symbols of objective phases. I could objectify the whole visual gestalt of night as a star, and I could make a symbol of a star in my mind. I could make a particular kind of a star. I could make a hermetic star with lines. I could make a five-pointed or six-pointed or seven-pointed star. I could have what is called a star or shield of David. I could have many symbols in my mind. They do not correspond to anything that is phenomenal and physiological, identifiable like that. So one begins to run into a referent problem. But you can also interiorize deeper than the level of symbolization. A symbol can be carried so deeply and condensed so much that one does not have an image. One does not have a symbol. But there is still the objective, the symbolically phenomenal objective sense of centering. I would like to center myself in this room in some kind of a meditation or some kind of a prayer, some kind of a contemplative focus. And with enough practice, one can learn to do that. If I now focus myself in this room interiorly, I do not have an image of it. I do not have a symbol of it. Nevertheless, it is mentally quite objective. Where is the referent for that? And of course, the old saying of this was the saying, beautifully put for us in the book of Exodus. Moses comes down and sees that Aaron has made everybody melt down their gold and made a nice little golden calf. And Moses gets angry. He's justifiably angry. To have some kind of an exterior image of a focus of the divine, of God, is a complete misunderstanding. Total misunderstanding. So that my sense of mental focus from my mind could be carried even further. I could not only have a point of presence in my mind, but I could condense that point of presence in my mind even further. What happens to it? It vanishes. So now there's no image, there's no symbol, there's no point of presence whatsoever. There's just undifferentiated mind. And while that's very difficult to do, nevertheless it can be done. Where's the referent for that? This kind of integral process has an end. It has an end right there, exactly there, where there is no image, no symbol, and no point of presence. One will say at that particular moment that one has gone beyond nature. One has gone as far as nature can go, that the ocean of nature, with all of its reach, has at last sent its last wave, which is crested, and there on that beach is as far as nature can possibly reach, that the integral process has gone as far as it can reach. And yet the occurrence of our reality extends beyond that. If one is sophomoric and limited to the body, in terms of recognition, one says, well, this is an out-of-the-body experience. Well, it's not only out of the body, it's completely out of the mind also. Where are you? You are not in a where. The geometry of time-space is irrelevant. It's extraneous. So that all of the experience of the geometry of time-space in a natural integrative application finds itself exhausted at this threshold, and it means that reality is much more than that. That everything that was natural time-space is a special case of reality and not the whole of it at all. And human beings, men and women, for a very, very, very long time, several hundred thousand years, have understood that out of the reach of the last wave of integration, there is a whole different way in which reality presents itself. Instead of presenting itself as a referent to phenomena, it presents itself as possibilities of exploration. And about 200 years ago, the word which was used for this, which has become misused since then through shoddy education, is irrational. One enters in not to the natural world, but to the rational world. Not to be confused with the mind. The rational world is not in the mind. Rational means ratioable. It means one deals not with identity in terms of phenomenon, but in terms of ratios, in terms of possibility. And the criteria now for reality is differential possibility and not at all integrated, identified phenomenality. So now language becomes magical. Instead of having a mythic quality of having a referent back to phenomenon, back to the things, language now has an open possibility where its referentiality is yet to be discovered. Words do not mean what is circumscribed by the boundary, but words now have a possibility of developing meaning out of boundlessness. This is a whole different language. Not just a different language, a completely different form of language. This is a language now which is responsive not to things, but eventually responsive to the storyteller. And so the grammar, the rhetorical structures of a magic language, of a conscious language, are those of poetry, are those of fairy tales, not those of myth, not those of description. But to get there, one has to have an education which allows for this kind of weaving and unweaving to happen to such an extent that you can stay with it long enough to witness, to experience, to think about, and to go beyond all of that and emerge into this visioning possibility. But that visioning process is just the beginning. It's like the nature of the other side of here. The here that's here in time-space is an event which happens in nature. But if one focuses not on the event that's here naturally, but let's say on the education that's happening at this moment, the language that's being used here is not at all a phenomenal language. It does not have an integral referential quality at all. Which, if that is all that you are used to in your life, it's very disturbing now to hear someone talk this way. Because I'm not only not dotting the I's and crossing the T's, I'm not even making the letters. Is this on purpose obfuscation to some extent? But it's not obfuscation, it's to keep your sense of possibility open so that you don't fall into the habitual hearing of referential language and try to imagine pictures of the things in your mind, which is about first grade level, that you keep an open mind so that the possibilities of creative exploration are viable. Because this particular lecture comes almost a year and three quarters into an education. That is all of one piece. It's just that now we're operating in a realm which is so rarefied in terms of the tribe that the tribes never imagined that it could possibly be real. It's the realms of the spirits. And so we are living in the realms of the spirit. But not absolutely. Exploratively. And so a defining language at this point would be a lying. And yet you find again and again you can consult any newspaper, any magazine, any catalog. There are millions of would-be teachers using a closed system, mythic, referential language to teach so-called New Age spiritual values. And it's what Henry Ford said it is, bunk. None of it, zero, is real. None. Not only not one thing real, but the very process of it is illusionary. Now this is a little disconcerting at first, but one can teach oneself, well, you can be educated to not only appreciate this, but to do a different way. And when you do, when those possibilities of openness, the juices that nourish those possibilities of openness flow in you, you yourself will teach yourself further. You will see with new eyes, you'll hear with new ears. Yes, it's true that Beethoven uses birdsong motifs in the Sixth Symphony, but if you listen to the Sixth Symphony, no bird ever whistled that. Even in Vienna, even on good days. So we're talking about something gorgeous. We're talking about something flamboyantly grand. We're talking about proofs of the spirit. We're talking about that we inhabit a reality that so overwhelms the limited lives that we are handed that it doesn't matter how they're described or what the specs are. They're little bitty platters in a field of food. This education is at the crossroads now, where we're beginning to realize that when you deal with processes, you have to deal with processes in their terms. When you deal with nature, you have to deal with nature in its terms. There used to be a thing, I think it's still going, called Outward Bound, that they would take incorrigible youngsters and row them out onto the Pacific Ocean, out of sight of land, and throw them overboard and let them deal with a real existential crisis. You have to find some kind of inner strength in order to deal with that situation. And it isn't just a matter of physiologically hoping you're going to survive to swim back to shore. You have to find some humane way to get them to row the boat back, that you're worth picking up, and you have to establish a relationship. You can't be willfully egotistical because the Pacific Ocean is rather large. It's very formidable. And you get it right away that, well, now maybe human life with cooperation has a purpose. Maybe it's a good thing to be nice and to interchange, and relationality, ratio-anality becomes something that is operative. This differential consciousness takes into consideration that you have both a dynamic and an energeia. It's both a quality which presences in objective and also has a dynamic in its own presence. The terms in the 20th century that have largely been singled out for this, objectivity, is very often called pragmatic, and the process flow is called pneumatic, spiritual. Pneumatic and pragmatic. Notice here that the objectivity, pragmos, pragmatos in Greek, means action. So right away there's a difficulty, because you think, well, because it's an action, it must be that must be the process. That ritual is a doing, right? So it must be a process. No, it's simplistic. It's the ritual action that defines the objectivity. What you do is the most accurate boundary of what you are. In existence. If you look to see what in a static, non-doing, non-active, what in a static objectivity something is, it disappears from sight. It disappears back into its nature. One wonders where it went. Faulkner has, in one of his wonderful short novels, which is a part of a novel called Go Down Moses. The title is from a Southern spiritual, Go Down Moses, Go to the Promised Land, Tell O Pharaoh, Let My People Go. It means that juncture where your people are getting free of the doctrinaire imposition of a structure from without, and you're seeking to be free to be turned loose in the Promised Land. It's not that this Promised Land has a new doctrine, it's that it's open. It has no doctrine. It's to be explored. And so a Promised Land like that is to be explored. In Go Down Moses, the section I'm talking about now is called The Bear. It's about a young boy, Isaac McCaslin, who is initiated in the big woods. He's taken there with the men who go with their guns and their liquor to go hunting. go hunting deer and prove to themselves that they're still men, they can still hunt and kill. And they end up drinking in the tents and playing cards and arguing. And an old half-black, half-Indian man named Sam Fathers tells the young man, the boy just about to become a man, he tells him that the woods, the big woods, are a place where one can learn about oneself in the most profound way, but that you cannot learn it as long as you carry a gun. And you cannot learn it as long as you carry a compass. And you cannot learn it as long as you carry a watch. As long as you carry an integral sense of time, an integral sense of space, and an integral sense of willful egotism, the watch, the compass, the gun, you're never going to be initiated by the big woods into itself, into its mystery. You're never going to be freed then to go into your own promised land. It's to set these aside. And the symbol of the big woods, of its freedom, of its immense mystery, is this old bear. This old bear who's rarely seen. Mythical, fabled bear. And yet the young Isaac McCaslin, when he sets, leans the gun against a tree, he drapes his compass from the barrel of the gun, and he leaves the watch on the log, and he goes out into the big woods, open, naked, free. He has let go of all those coordinates, all those Cartesian geometries that make one secure. It's the first time he notices a footprint, this kind of misshapen, gnarled footprint that the old bear is said to leave. And so he follows these footprints until he sees that some of the footprints are filling up with water from the damp floor of the big woods, and that the footprints must be very recent because they haven't yet filled up with water. And then he looks up, and in the sun-dappled phantasmagoria of the open woods, no longer identified, there's the old bear watching him. Whatever you're looking for is looking for you. And that moment of finding is not finding it, but of mutual discovery. Discovery. And the old bear looks at him and turns without any effort whatsoever and fades back into the forest. And Isaac McCaslin has this mystical moment that the bear has made him a part of the forest. He doesn't need to kill. He doesn't need to coordinate where he is. He doesn't care what time it is. And he also discovers that he has a stronger tie with the woods, with the bear, than he does with the men drinking back in camp. But Sam Fathers, what he told him is that man is a part of the way things are, a part of the pragmatos that comes out of nature, that he is quite extant in existence, and that that is a key that opens up the whole mystery of nature to him, that he can participate in that nature, but it also opens up on the other side the whole mystery of language. And the way Faulkner writes it, he uses that kind of fairy tale language, the magic language that you didn't notice at first. You thought was very difficult writing, because he's like, wow, this stream of consciousness, Southern American writer who thinks he's like a Mississippi Proust, and what kind of language is this? All of a sudden, at that point, if you're with him, the language begins to fan out its wings and fly. Because the page-long sentences are a differential flow of scintillating jewel-like possibility. That he's not interested in saying short sentences which little agency readers can identify as, that's the way people talk. Is it? Even 10,000 years ago, men and women used to talk that talk to each other because they together went through some kind of a portal, and they recognized not only do they get to participate in the mysteries of nature and language, but there's a mysterious process called magical conscious vision also that occurs, and that they participate with that. And not in a way of fitting in integrally, but in a way of fitting in increasingly with openness. And on the far side of spiritual personhood, there's a fourth process called history, which is completely wild, totally wild. One thought nature was wild, or language was wild, or vision, but history is really wild. It's like exponentially more open than vision. And it's this kind of a quality which challenges. And in our particular situation, it's a challenge that's unmet, because in order to meet it, there has to be a response that shares with it. If you try to club something like that, you're just swinging through midair. Your arms aren't even long enough to reach 6 feet, much less 1 billion light years. Why is the dimension of history that large? Because it doesn't just deal with the past, which we now know is millions of years. Because history has enlarged itself in the 20th century. Early in the 20th century, the 1920s, 1926, the Scopes trial for teaching evolution in Tennessee became a wonderful play, Inherit the Wind. William Jennings Bryan defended the whole notion that the Bible says that God created the universe. And we figured out, because some Irish bishop named Usher figured out by the chronologies, that it happened in 4004 BC. So all of time is 6,000 years old. And so man is quite obviously no more than 6,000 years old tops. Well, not only was that held up until the 1920s, and still in the 1990s by many people, but 200 years before that was the first time that someone really got the perception that the scale of time was much larger than anyone had realized, and that person was Benjamin Franklin. Franklin put together the fact that there were layers of geology that had marine fossils in them that obviously had been laid down, that there were life forms in an ocean in parts of what is today Pennsylvania, and was just beginning to become Pennsylvania at that time. Some of the coal field geology showed that there was marine life, who knows how many millions, hundreds of millions, who knew at that time, in the early 1700s. But it was certainly more than 6,000 years. Someone like a Benjamin Franklin becomes an interesting case in point of someone who takes a personal transformation and then puts his personal transformed self into a historical process, so that the vectors and sets that make up history now have a transformed individual as a part of their vectoring. And it turns out that someone like that has a magical effect, or we would say today has a conscious effect. Just like the transformed mind, when it enters into vision, the visionary process changes the way in which the visionary process happens. An integrated mind absorbed into a visionary process is able to precipitate out as a person, as a differential person. That differential person entering into a historical process is able to produce a real objective cosmos. That's what is called the great work. That's really difficult, yet it can be done. The case of Benjamin Franklin is taking a transformed individual and putting himself into a historical process, and out of this comes a number of developments. One of them is the American Revolution, another is the French Revolution, the third is the Scientific Revolution. There are a number of changes that happen. And out of this comes realization that a transformed, conscious person who puts themselves into a historical process is able to carry that transformed quality. It's like they become a wild card and the game is different. The game now is not just played with the deck as dealt, but there are wild cards in the deck. You have to play it completely different. And that reality's very sharp card player, as soon as there's anything extra in the deck, it's used. That we know. That the divine is not at all against using all of the elements that count. Anything that's realistically there, you're in the game. This is what happens. Now, Franklin learned this because he was able to read classical history. In fact, he read two classical historians, one of which we're reading now and one which we're going to be reading for the next month. He read Thucydides, the Greek historian, and he read Tacitus, the Roman historian, who we're going to read next. Thucydides identified, increasingly as he wrote his history, that individuals not only count, it's not just that great individuals make history, but they change the way in which history happens. And the history of the Peloponnesian War is a case in point of the unfolding. While he's writing it over a period of many, many years, Thucydides self-discovers the possibility of individual transformation of historical processes, so that the history ends as we have it. He died, and so he wasn't able to finish it. It ends with his great arch-protagonist Alcibiades in the midst of a power play which was like a triple cross. Alcibiades, who'd become the great Athenian con man general, and then had become a traitor and gone over to the Spartan side and become the great Athenian con man general as a Spartan con man general, and then had betrayed them and went over to the Persians. Eventually he was killed by the Persians, who recognized that he was a very good con man general and too much of a wild card. Thucydides develops in his history increasingly a respect for a recognition that a really powerfully integrated mind, which gets its differential form in terms of a viable person, that figure entering into history is able to change the way in which history happens. They don't just make history, but they change the way in which history can happen. They open up its possibilities. And as they discover this, they discover that there are no written limitations whatsoever to the differential conscious person with an integrated mind and with a organized society to work with. In fact, this was the whole point of Thucydides, that a human population which has been combed out by ideational education to make them conformed in such a way that they have a shared focus becomes ever so much more powerful than any kind of monarchy. But it turns out, in Thucydides' time, that a democracy can be more of a tyranny than a aristocracy. That it has more latent problems. That there's one thing about a king who goes bad, but there's something about a people that becomes a mobocracy. The bad gunslinger is not as dangerous as the lynch mob. They are more dangerous. And out of Thucydides' concern, it took about 500 years for it to really sink in to where there was a conscious historian who lived in a time where the mobocracy was like on a world empire scale. The historian was Tacitus, and the world empire mobocracy was the degenerate Roman Empire of the age of Nero and Caligula and the crowd. And Tacitus lived through it. Like Thucydides, he not only lived through it, but he wrote a history of it. So that one could understand, so that someone like Benjamin Franklin could come in and he could read Thucydides, he could read Tacitus, and he could understand that he, by transforming himself in a specific way, he used it by, if you read your little assignments, you know that he arranged his whole personality, rearranged it, transformed it with charts, and he did it on a weekly basis. And he completely, consciously modified himself so that he became not someone new, but someone who was constantly new. But he had to watch out because it was Alcibiades' chameleon-like, identity-less, con man qualities that led to the complete dismemberment of classical Greek civilization. Alcibiades, who'd been raised in the household of Pericles, whose stepmother was Aspasia, Pericles' lady, the ex-courtesan, who used flash to show the Athenian aristocracy that even an ex-prostitute with enough power could run the city and do things her way. And Alcibiades was a combination of Pericles' specific grandeur and Aspasia's flash expectations, and he became that kind of a person. He became the pretty boy, glamorous genius who simply, when he was with the Spartans, he had long hair and ate black broth. When he was with the Persians, he had ostentatious pomp. When he was with the Athenians, he was a democrat. Because the difficulty of not making a complete differential transformation is that one becomes selfless like in chaos. And Alcibiades is a perfect kind of a madness which infests our own time. The world is populated by millions of Alcibiades today. They're everywhere. They're all over places. And they're the doers, the shakers. They're what make things happen. Only nothing's happening. Nothing's doing. And because history is quite real, its juices, instead of being creative for furthering the exploration of possibility, are turning into acid rain. The first thing they dissolve are weak individuals. So, of course, the gut reaction is to become stronger, more together, got to go to the gym, got to go to this technique, that technique. History dissolves those kinds of efforts without any problem whatsoever. There's nothing, no protection whatsoever there. Wide open, sitting ducks. So the next level is the mind. So the mind tries to collect itself And of course, without training, minds do not collect themselves against that kind of regressive tidal wave very easily, because not only do you have history, but you have the flotsam of the whole person structure, which has collapsed. It's like a torrential flood that carries all the shards, the logs of things that have been destroyed, the masonry. And this corrosive quality comes all the way through visionary consciousness into the mind. And the mind, which has never been used to being objective, just doesn't offer any resistance. And so it finally comes back like that to the body. And people are ill. They're allergic to everything. I've got this and that. Well, of course. What are you going to do? You've got a flood of acid rain carrying the debris of several levels of objectivity and all of the muddied waters of phony vision. And it comes all the way through a garbled language, a garbled feeling tone quality, until finally the only honest thing left in reality is the body. That takes it exactly where it's most sensitive. That's how regression goes to where you're weakest. And so we live in a time where existence is simply reeling from what it was never prepared to do. It was prepared to emerge out of the mystery of nature and be. It was prepared to develop the kind of experience that's there in language and feeling and myth and go from there. But it was never meant. It has no chance. The body has no chance against the corrosive debris that a flooding historical process throws. And so, 200 years ago, someone invented a philosophy of history. His name was Voltaire. Voltaire, who was a personal friend of Benjamin Franklin's. Next week, we're going to come back not only to Tacitus, pick up some of Thucydides, and show how 500 years later, Tacitus in the Roman Empire sees with renewed clarity what Thucydides was getting at and completes it. But we're going to take a step back from Benjamin Franklin, because there were spiritual persons. Many times before, we're going to take a woman who lived a couple hundred years before Benjamin Franklin. We're going to take St. Teresa of Avila. Because St. Teresa of Avila is one of the world's great differential personages. You have to forget that she's a medieval Spanish mystic. She's a phenomenal, noumenal spiritual person who writes her own autobiography. In an age where women were largely dismissed, she stood out like a single pinnacle. So we're going to read some of the autobiography, the life written of St. Teresa of Avila herself, where she points out how stupidly willful she was for a long time, expecting that she was going to be okay if she just adopted certain doctrines and just fit in and became a safe recluse, only to discover that there's a lot of exposure and there's no safety whatsoever when you go inside into that interior castle, as she said, and you find that the whole place is haunted. She was so mature that she had the respect of one of the greatest male mystics of all time, St. Juan of the Cross. St. John of the Cross looked up to Teresa of Avila as his mother, because she was really wise about the ways of reality. So we're going to look at Teresa of Avila and Tacitus for a moment, but we're going to keep catching up Thucydides and Benjamin Franklin. But now that you know that future history is as important as past history, you might want to start looking ahead. Now, you can look ahead like Heinlein's Future History, or like Isaac Asimov's Foundation, Psychohistory, or you can look ahead in terms of the course, in terms of this process that we're in now. And after Teresa and Tacitus, we're going to take Hegel and Burckhardt. Burckhardt, who was the first to realize that there were shapes in philosophic history, and that the shapes made gestalts such that he was able to look at a whole realm of human history and call it the Renaissance. And Hegel, who looked just before Burckhardt and saw that history was a spiritual flow that had something noumenal about its process, and that you had to stop trying to objectify it in terms of identities and reference, and you had to learn the dialectic of Platonic dialoguing in a Socratically ignorant, in a deotemically alert way, and then you could learn to swim. And when you swam with this flow, something happened. You gained a certain kind of a strength. So we're going to look ahead, not only to the next month, but look ahead beyond that to the month after that. And if you do that, you get used to the fact that looking ahead looks ahead more and more. This is the way in which you alert yourself to the differential possibilities. You don't know what they are going to be, but you recognize that you don't know. But you continue to explore, not because you're afraid or you're encouraged of not knowing, but simply that you do it. This reaches back and transforms ritual. It brings your existence, catches it right up into the very act of differentiating. It turns out that this education is a very peculiar way to develop. And as soon as you get used to it, you'll find that it opens up at an asymptotic rate. It may take a long time to learn to begin to do this, but once you do, it opens up very, very quickly. You haven't lost any time at all. More next week. Thank you.